If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to The Tool Shed, a podcast covering all levels of professional baseball to help give you the edge in your dynasty leagues. From the MLB draft all the way to the show, The Tool Shed podcast has you covered with rankings, player analysis, and in-depth discussion. And now, here's your host, Eric Cross.
What's up, everyone? Welcome into another episode of the Tool Shed podcast brought to you by Rotoballer. This is episode 421. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Eric Cross. You can find me on Twitter at EricCrossMLB. Finishing up my 2025 rookie review series. I already did infield and outfield, and let's head to the mound here with a great guest. Just saw him out at First Pitch Arizona. And usually when I introduce a guest like this, I say something like, you know, the one, the only, but he might not be the only anymore.
Not anymore.
If you heard some of the, or saw some of the pictures or heard a podcast or two from First Pitch Arizona, you'll know what I'm talking about. But I'm 99% sure I have the real Paul Sporer at Sporer on Twitter. Obviously, writer, podcaster, Fangraphs, Sleeper on the Bus podcast. Paul, how's it going, bud?
Eric, it's going well, man. Thanks so much for having me on. It was awesome seeing you this weekend. Yeah, the doppelganger thing was incredible. A guy, Andy Bell, who looks exactly like me, similar age, and from Detroit, from Dearborn specifically. I'm from Allen Park. People who know the greater Detroit area are going to know how close those two are. I was born in Dearborn Hospital. So, like, it's just insane. And, you know, my father has passed, so he'll have to answer for this in heaven when I get there. But for now, he's skating on some BS because I need to know what's going on. But no, Andy was great. The thing was, too, it did look like he was cosplaying me because he was all decked out in Detroit garb. But no, he's just a Tigers fan. Good guy, too. I really enjoyed that. And like you said, had him on our Family Feud team, too, so it was a blast.
Oh, yeah, that was fun. The Family Feud thing was an absolute blast. I wish I got to see more of it. But, yeah, I saw Doppelganger before you on the
a
first
lot of people
day.
Did
yeah, so it was at the welcome reception, and we were in line for food, and he was like to my right, and I was about to go big, oh hey Paul, how's it going? And I was like, I'd start stop and look for a second. I'm like, wait a minute, this is not Paul Sporer.
Like seven people told me about him before I'd even checked in. Have you seen your doppelganger? I'm like, I've not. And then when I did, I'm like, okay, I see the hype was real. And again, he was perfect. A full sport about it. He was awesome. And Andy Bell, great guy. And I'm glad he came. I hope he comes next year because we had a lot of fun with it. We did some bits and everything.
Yeah, it was great. A lot of first-timers out there this year,
Yeah.
Which was phenomenal. New record over 200. It was like 205 or something
first
like that.
First sellout.
Yes, it was phenomenal.
30-year anniversary.
And I know it can be hard. You know, you take a few days off, the money aspect of it, the travel aspect. But if you can swing it, I'm sure Paul will recommend it too. Like, highly recommended. You know, we
can't recommend it enough.
We've both been going for a long time, Sporer longer than me. So it's a phenomenal event. Talk baseball, watch baseball, and just hang out with some good people. And shout out to Baseball HQ, especially Brent and Ray, who just kind of spearhead this every year and just put on a phenomenal event year after year. So
the balancing act, I mean, putting it all together, again, it's expanded so much.
Yep.
When I went, I was like basically there as kind of like Jason Collette's son. I was the youngest person there by like a decade, easy. And then he was like next youngest. So I don't think Jason's a decade older than me, but like we were like the youngest, and then it was a 10-year jump. And then we've seen it evolve so much. First off, an expansion in volume, then skew younger, now bringing in more diverse voices, a lot more women each year. And obviously, we're still like probably low double digits at this point. But folks, we used to be like, Mordecai Brown could count them every year for quite some time. Okay. Yep. And if you don't know that, Mordecai, three finger Brown. And so that wasn't great. So now again, we're expanding on everything. I say we, it's not my event, but I don't think Ray and Brent would take this as anything negative, but I take some ownership over it in that I've been going for 16 years. I love it. I'm always trying to grow it. I've been Justin and I have been telling people on the pod for years, if you can do one event, you know, it is a big expenditure. I understand traveling is not easy, especially today. You know, you and I just talked about delays, you know, getting back before we started the pod. So I understand all of that. But if you are someone prone to travel and you want to find a cool trip, First Pitch Arizona, you can't go wrong. It's an amazing weekend every time. 16 years for me. Streak only broken by COVID, too.
I know. That darn COVID. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm up to, I think I'm right about halfway from you. I think this is my eighth year going out.
Yeah, you've been coming for a good bit now.
Yeah, it's so fun. This week was just absolutely perfect weather. It's like low to mid-80s the entire time out there. That was phenomenal. And I got to see some good baseball and hear some good panels. So highly recommend it. But yes, we are talking some rookie pitchers today. A lot of fun ones. You know, this was a really exciting year for kind of rookie pitchers. And in my previous two installments of the series, I had not been going over guys that were still prospect eligible. Like, I didn't go over Basayo, but I'm going to make one exception here for the first guy on the list, and that's Trey Savage, just because it feels like, yeah, he's still rookie eligible next year, but given all his, you know, postseason innings, he kind of feels a little like an exception to the rule for this episode here. And what a phenomenal year for Trey Savage. I don't know how I could find the stat. I'm sure, like, Sarah Langs or someone that's, you know, super smart and that type of stuff can find it. But to be pitching in low A and the World Series in the same year is just probably something that's barely ever happened. But that's what happened with Savage, low A, high A, double A, triple A, few starts in the majors, you know, the divisional series, championship series, and the World Series with a couple really phenomenal outings along the way, including that 12 strikeout game against the Dodgers in the World Series. So, you know, ADP is already, a lot of these guys, ADP is already getting pretty high. The hype is high on these guys long term. So we'll start off with like the guy that's kind of the buzziest name right now with Savage. You know, are you buying the hype right now, Paul, on Savage?
No, probably not at the price point. You know, you talk about, oh, we got some early drafts right now. We have 12 draft champions. That's 50-round draft and hold. That's the real sickos getting in and doing those drafts. It's kind of a good way to kind of acclimate yourself with the player pool right away if you want to kind of be a year-round player. I usually hold off until November. I will probably sign up my first one of the year this week. And you Savage around pick 150 there at 147 with a high of 110. And I would imagine it's rising as well. That's a little bit too much for me. You know, we saw a great sample from him, but how many times have we seen a guy be electric for a short sample and then get figured out a bit and have to make an adjustment that can last even upwards of a year? And I'm not suggesting that that will take you Savage that long, but I just don't think he's a finished product enough to take at that price point. I've been prone to some shiny new toys at times. I think in my older age, maybe I've skewed away a little bit. I'll still glom on to some guys for sure and pay the freight all the way up the board. But with your Savage, I just can't. With pitchers, it's a lot harder. I think I find myself doing it more with hitters that I believe in. You know, somebody like Nick Kurtz, who just won Rookie of the Year tonight, we're recording this on Monday, already in the second round, maybe first round, depending on certain leagues. That's a little bit different to me, even though it's much more expensive than your Savage. I can't do it at inside pick 150. My boy Gavin Williams, who's a young guy, also figured some things out, had some ups and downs of his own, goes right there too. I'm taking Williams every time over your Savage right now.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up Williams because I feel like there's some similarities with these two, not in terms of like the arsenal, but like, you know, guys that can miss a lot of bats, but also, you know, can the command control can kind of get a little wonky at times.
Exactly.
And that's why I saw Trey Savage twice in Double A, and that's kind of what I was thinking about him. I was like, all right, this guy can miss some bats. The stuff is really good, but you know, sometimes he just gets, you know, in his own head and starts trying to nibble too much, and all of a sudden he's got, you know, four walks in five innings or something like that. So, yeah, you Savage, like, out of all, like, I like you Savage, but out of all,
I do too.
I like this all, like, you know, like what it was, you know, call it the hype.
Oh, the
seven.
Hype seven, yeah,
the hype seven, which is perfect because it perfectly describes, like, you know, that range of drafts next year. But yeah, out of all the, like, this cluster of arms, these young rookie arms or second year arms, yeah, I think I'm a little more hesitant to go in on a Savage right now. But yeah, that's
just gotta be careful.
Yeah, like, that splitter's nasty though. I love that splitter.
It really is, and it's easy to kind of get excited about what he did on the biggest, most important stage. The resolve he showed, you know, it's hard to quantify that, but you see a guy on the biggest stage do that, and I understand getting excited, but he's going to have ups and downs. Every pitcher does, and I think he's going to take some lumps next year, and I just don't think he's going to return value on pick 150.
Yeah, no, that's definitely fair. But long term, I think this guy could be like a top, you know, like a top 30 or so, but not like an ace.
Definitely,
but
maybe, agree with
maybe
that.
Like an SP2, SP3 range long term. Next guy, keep it right in the American League East, go to the Yanks with Cam Schlittler. Like this guy, I mean, he was like a decent prospect, not like a top prospect, but he just really popped off and had a phenomenal start against my Red Sox in game 3 of the wild card round. It was funny because I was talking to a couple Yankee fan friends, and I was like, man, as a Red Sox fan, I hated what he was doing, but as a baseball fan, I was just really appreciating what this rookie was doing in the postseason. I mean, I think it was, what, 8 shutout with 12 Ks, if I remember correctly. And it was either 0 or 1 walk, I forget, but not a lot of walks in that game, if I recall correctly. But overall this year, you know, he had more starts in the major leagues than Yesavage did, 14 starts, ERA just under 3 at 2.96, over a K per inning, 27.5% strikeout rate. You know, a lot of high velocity with Cam Schlittler. You know, 3 of his offerings, 4-seam cutter, sinker, all above 90. 4-seam and sinker around 97, 98. So a lot of hard stuff, but not like a lot of any huge whiff rates on any individual offering. So how are you kind of treating Schlittler this year moving forward? Like, are you buying the kind of the pop-off we saw from him this past year?
I am. I do like Cam Schlittler quite a bit. I like the talent, and I like that we got 73 innings. That is still a small sample, but it is, again, you know, compared to Yesavage, even if you count the playoffs, what, that was 30 innings and 15 at the major league level. So, you know, you're talking 45 if you add both. So you're still looking at quite a bit more with the 73 for Schlittler. Both small samples. I think maybe, you know, similar sort of vibe of like, okay, do you really want to pay full freight? Because he's up at 137 on this ADP range right now, Schlittler is. And that's still pretty expensive. So I'm probably still not going to end up with a lot of him. But between the two, I've got a lot more confidence in what he can do because I think he's got a better command profile. Now, he still walked 10% at the major league level, but that's still better than Yesavage in his small sample. And we saw Yesavage putting up easy double-digit rates coming up, whereas Schlittler was more of a guy who early on had some struggles, but had, you know, at least in part of this year, gotten that down a bit. His double and triple A work, 8% and 9% respectively, before it bounced back up a little bit in the major leagues. So I think he's got the bat missing ability with a better command profile, and that makes me like Schlittler more. Still a little bit nervous at 137, but if I was going to take a younger guy there in that range and say Gavin Williams was gone, I could go for Schlittler, whereas I would still be passing Yesavage.
Yeah, I think for 2026 alone, I do lean Schlittler over Yesavage. Long term, I think I could maybe sway the other way a little bit, but they're both pretty close in my rankings, both for, you know, next year and long term, like in the dynasty format. So, but yeah, Schlittler, I mean, you look at, he's just really, he gives me like, I mean, he throws a little harder than Lance Lynn did. Remember how Lance Lynn was just like, everything was pretty, like, it was like fastball, cutter, sinker, not a lot of like, you know, breaking or off speed. That kind of gives me kind of the vibe I get from a Cam Schlittler. And yeah, he just seems like
dominant. And you know, I brought this up with Yesavage, and again, I can't quantify it, so I don't go too hard on it. It's not like my drafting philosophy, but his demeanor I find super impressive. And actually, it took away, it was actually kind of a boring interview that he had on MLB Central. I don't want to be too rude, but like, that actually played into it, though, too. The fact that, like, he's just kind of always even keel. Maybe I wish he had a little bit more juice for a morning interview show, but I'm not really worried about player interviews. But then kind of seeing how he just kind of always keeps his cool, even when his starts are going bad. And I'm not saying that if a guy punches their glove or swears that I'm automatically out on them. I'm that kind of person. So, you know, who would I be to throw stones? But I do appreciate a young guy who can kind of keep their composure when they come up and they hit some bumps, because you're inevitably going to, right? What's one of the biggest cliches about baseball? It's a game of failure. And, you know, you do tend to see the guys that do overreact all the time. They a lot of times burn out. It's harder for the hotheads to put up the decade-long career. You know, you get your exceptions. Tommy Pham is still knocking around, and there's some other guys too. But, like, generally, if you're that high and that low for everything in baseball, it's gonna make you crazy. And so I thought Schlittler was somebody that, and again, Yesavage as well, that kind of had their composure, at least in the little glimpses that I was able to get from them. I don't know them personally.
Yeah, and I feel like it's especially important with Schlittler's pitching in New York, right? Half his starts being in New York for the Yankees, obviously. Then, you know, the name on that jersey means a lot. It's like, you know, not the slight like Pittsburgh or Miami, but it's like,
no, but it's harder to pitch there. Like, we can't pretend it isn't. Now, I've always pushed back on the idea that, like, everyone who doesn't succeed there didn't succeed because of the city, which you're not saying, by the way, so that's not an argument against you. But I've always pushed back on that narrative. Like, guys can just be bad there because they didn't pitch well, not because the media and the fans got to them. But you'd be deluding yourselves to pretend that pitching in New York, either New York really, but especially the Yankees, isn't much different and frankly more difficult than literally anywhere else. Just the media coverage. I mean, you can't pick your nose there without getting a little story about it somewhere. Whereas in Pittsburgh, you could probably pitch a no-no and, you know, you might get a blurb. No, I'm kidding, Pittsburgh. I'm kidding. They're actually a good sports town, right? They got a terrible owner, but if they had a good owner, I guarantee they would show the hell out at PNC because that's a great stadium. So, you know, I'm taking a little shots at them, but it's more because they're the worst team or one of the worst teams in the league. Dude, and I'm making a point.
Right.
I just don't want Pittsburgh to come after me. Midwest type people, you know. I guess that's not really Midwest, but they got a Midwest vibe. And I'm from the Midwest, so I know how scary we can be.
Yeah, I feel like Pittsburgh's kind of like almost like the gateway to the Midwest. They're kind of like right near that cutoff, right?
As soon as I said that, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of far east, but like they got hella Midwest vibes, which I know hella is like a total West Coast word to then say Mid-Coast vibes with. But anyway.
But it was funny, you know, when those whole, you know, Paul Skeens trade rumors were, you know, or at least were being tweeted about. And
yeah,
I had some people, like, when I made a comment, people were replying to me saying that, like, basically they would be okay giving up Skeens if it meant Bob Nutting went with them. Like,
oh, my God,
that's,
yes.
That's how bad it's gotten. Now, you're willing to get rid of your generational pitcher if it means
just to get rid of that owner because of how much it would help just to get a new owner. I mean, it wouldn't help for sure. I guess there's feasibly a way to get a worse owner, but I doubt it. It does seem that, I mean, I'd have to maybe sit down and judge this, so I don't want to commit too much to this, but I do feel like the newer owners have at least, in some cases that I can think of, have come in and said they're more open to spending and trying to actually win as opposed to buying the team to be an ATM for them. Like, you know, everyone criticized the Orioles for not spending. It was actually Elias, not the ownership, right? Like,
right.
They said he could spend, and he's like, no, I want to do it like the Rays for some reason. Hey, good job. It worked.
Anyway. Oh, absolutely. And Baltimore kind of fell off hard this year.
They collapsed, dude. And it's completely his fault. Now, I advocated that they sign Burns and that didn't work either. So it's not like I had the answers, but the fact that they sat on their hands, I thought was so bizarre. Anyway, we got to move on to our next guy, Noah Cameron, right?
Humminson. Yeah, Noah Cameron, this guy is kind of an interesting profile. I mean, he had an ERA just a hair under three, right at 2.99, 24 starts, you know, solid 1.10 whip. You know, K rate, it was not nearly as high as what we had seen in the minor leagues, though the whiff rate, you know, was pretty solid. I still think there's some more. It actually was above average whiff rate, but below average strikeout rate.
Right.
So I think there's a chance you see that strikeout rate move up. But yeah, a lot of his ERA indicators were like in that, you know, 4 to 4.2, 4.3 range. So yeah, kind of an interesting profile here from Noah Cameron. So how are you kind of evaluating him moving forward?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about Cameron, too. And again, you know, you talk about this hype 7, and Eno might need to expand it because there are so many interesting young pitchers for next year. And it's not just the rookies, but this rookie class, while it didn't have a lot of banger seasons, like nobody thought that Kurtz was going to lose Rookie of the Year. He was so far out above the pack. The rest of the pack was really good. It's just that he was amazing. And so he kind of made it look like a weak AL class. But Noah Cameron was right there. He had a wonderful season. I know he finished outside the top three. It was Wilson and Roman Anthony who joined Kurtz there. Of course, I'm sure they both knew, like, we don't have a chance at this, right? This is Kurtz all the way. He won it unanimously. But Cameron is much cheaper than the first two guys we talked about. Almost 100 picks cheaper than Schlittler at 234. And that is, there's a reason for that, by the way. He's not as talented as them, but he is remarkably talented, and he's in a place that can play to his strengths, right? You mentioned that the strikeout rate isn't quite there yet for Cameron. Well, that's good. At least he plays in a spot, usually with quality defense. I actually don't know how good their defense was this year. They have reputationally good defense, but I'll have to check on that to see where Casey was after this season. But it is a more spacious park that will prevent some homers, which he does have a little bit of a problem with, because he's a control guy. He lives in the zone. He wants to beat you in the zone. So while he does have that 12% swing and strike rate, it hasn't completely translated to strikeouts yet. Only 21% for Cameron. If he can get right around the 24%, because you can usually take your swing and strike rate, multiply it by two, and get kind of an expected strikeout rate. If he can get up to that 24%, I think it can be a fantasy stud for his price. If you can get him in around the 230s and get like a 370 ERA, 112 to 114 whip, and almost a strikeout per inning, because I think they turn him loose next year. There's no reason, he made 24 starts this year. Why wouldn't he make 30 next year? So I think Cameron's a good volume bet as long as he's healthy. He's 26. There's no need to baby him. I think he can be a sub 4 ERA guy with a big whip and enough Ks. And even if the rate doesn't improve, he can beat you. He can get you with volume then. Because if he throws 185 innings, I'll take the 160-something Ks that come with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I just pulled up the defensive stats here. And you were spot on. The Royals were third in outs above average, only behind St. Louis and Houston. And defensive run saves, they were tied with Cleveland for seventh. So
excellent. So a ball and play guy in a park that's a little bit more spacious to curb a few homers. Again, it's not like crazy pitcher park, but it's a little bit more pitcher park with good defense. I think that's a place to succeed while Cameron tries to figure out the strikeout rate if it is going to come forward.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at is, I do think the ERA comes back a little bit, but at the same time, I think he can offset that by, adding 3-4 or so percent, maybe gets up to that 25-ish percent strikeout rate range, which I think he's absolutely capable of just from seeing him in the minor leagues and the stuff he has, deep five-pitch arsenal, pretty good mix of pitches there, pretty even distribution for the most part. So like four-seam, cut, curve, change, slider. So I think you can be 25% K rate guy. Maybe it's more like a 3.5 ERA, but hey, that'll play, and that's still about a top 50 pitcher or so.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I don't love Cameron like I do some of these other guys, but I like Cameron, and I think he just given all the other bigger, sexier names, from this rookie class last year, I feel like he's getting a little slept on. So I think you can get some good value in a lot of different leagues on Cameron in 26.
He's going right in between Matthew Boyd and Merrill Kelly, which is kind of interesting because he's kind of a young version of them.
Yeah.
And now I want to be clear that just because you're young, you don't inherently have upside. I think we do that a little bit too much in fantasy baseball where we're like, because we'll say like an old guy can't have upside, but a young guy inherently does. And neither of those are true. Like Matthew Boyd, for example, had a lot of upside this year because he stayed healthy. But anyway, the point is that we do both believe that Cameron has like that strikeout upside with it. So even if he's just a younger Matthew Boyd or Merrill Kelly, we'll take that at pick 234. But if that strikeout rate jumps, then all of a sudden he's a guy who plays inside the top 200 and you got him much cheaper than that.
Absolutely. Another AL Central guy here that had a really good end of the season that I don't think is getting talked about enough. Joey Cantillo kind of transitioned from being kind of like that long reliever, kind of multiple inning guy for Cleveland, went into the rotation full-time after the All-Star break, made 10 starts post-All-Star break, a 2.48 ERA, 1.12 WHIP, and basically almost a strikeout per inning on the nose, 54 Ks in 54 and a third innings. So kind of a really sneaky good end to the year to that. I think some people had already checked out for football a little bit when Cantillo was kind of having his run. Overall, at a 27% strikeout rate, a little bit of a higher walk rate, 10.5%, but what do you think about Joey Cantillo here, Paul?
This is the run I've been waiting for. I've been a Cantillo guy for a while, not that long, obviously, because he only was in the majors last year and this year, but somebody that I've been advocating for. And each time he comes up, kind of going back to that well, hoping that something can click. And down the stretch, it finally did. Now, I don't think we're out of the woods in terms of the volatility that comes with Cantillo, because he is definitely a control problem. During this run, though, he did get it down to 8% walk rate. If he can be around 8-9%, even 10%, we could live with. 10% is still pretty high, but for somebody like him who can trend in the teens at times when he's really off, I'll take something that's right there at that 8-9 ideally, because he's got a lot of swing and miss stuff as a lefty. And Nick Pollock liked to underscore this weekend with regards to Cleveland. This is something I've always liked about them. They let their young guys pitch. They let them figure things out on the major league stage. If they called them up, they're there to pitch. And if they're pitching well, they're going to be able to get the opportunity at 5, 6, 7 innings. Now, with Cantillo, that's going to require not walking guys. Now, he could end up being a five and dive guy even on Cleveland just because the pitch counts get pushed up too much. But we saw down the stretch that when he was working at an 8% rate, that Cantillo was able to mix in some 6-inning games, including an 8-inning masterpiece against Kansas City, where he threw 8 innings of shutout ball with 4 hits, 5 Ks, and 0 walks. He even had 2 0 walk games during that run, but he did have some 4 walk games as well, and a lot of 2s mixed in. So it's going to come down to the control, but he's 272. So he's starting to get into that territory where you're taking guys with at least 1 wart. His is obvious, it's clear, but it's still something that I'm willing to jump on because I really like Cantillo. And I think that at that price point, his risk is worth taking on, because even if he doesn't quite come all the way, I probably at least have a team streamer or an easy cut, right? If I look up on May 1st and he's got a 5.12 ERA, then I cut Cantillo and I move on.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's definitely one of those guys you could absolutely do that with. And yeah, Cantillo is a guy that I always kind of liked a little bit, but you know, he really kind of opened my eyes at the end of the season here, and that changeup is absolutely filthy. I think it's already one of the better changeups in all of baseball. And I just pulled up, I had a couple of tweets about him in mid-September, so these weren't like full end of the season stats, so these might have changed a little bit, but I had two tweets almost a couple days apart that included him. So he was, as of the 16th of September, ranked second in rookie starting pitcher whiff rate, only behind Chase Burns. And then for there's only four pitchers with a minimum of 200 pitches thrown on an offering to have a whiff rate above 50% on an offering. Cantillo at the time had 51%. It did dip down slightly below 50 end of the season, but at the time it was him 51% on the changeup, Freddie Peralta 50.4% on the slider, Logan Gilbert 51% on the splitter, and leading the way was Zach Wheeler 54.5% on the curveball. So just so that the changeup super elite, good, you know, good whiff potential there with Cantillo. He's already showing. So yeah, I think both him and Cameron kind of sneaky good values this year. So
if you want to get in on the hyped rookie class, I think you should wait. Again, I'm not saying that you Savage and Schlittler aren't better than these guys, but it's not big enough for 100 to 150 picks, in my opinion. I think they're much closer, but those other two guys have a lot of hype, whereas Cantillo and Cameron are flying under the radar a bit.
Yeah, no, 100%. If you want the better value play this year, I think, yeah, Cameron, Cantillo could be the better value plays there. All right, let's go. Let's finish out the American League with some guys from my team, the Red Sox, and your team, the Detroit Tigers.
Perfect.
Red Sox had two fun little rookies here come up, you know, end of the season. Peyton Tolley made his debut against Paul Skeens, pitched well, then fell off, had some blow-ups. So, overall stat line, not overly exciting for him. But Connelly Early came up, had four really good outings, 24-4 strikeout-to-walk ratio for Connelly Early. Probably a little bit of a leg up on Tolley. Oh, excuse me, 29-4 strikeout to walk ratio. Pardon me. Even better than that. 24-4.
He was unbelievable.
Good. Yeah, 29-4. And you look at just Savant. I mean, four game sample size, but a lot of red on that Savant page as well. I think there's a ton of upside for both of these guys, and they're both going, you know, in redraft leagues. I think Early was, I think, around 220, if I recall, and Tolley was like 50 or so picks after that. And you got to wait to see. I mean, the Red Sox have said, we want to go out and get a number two. Who knows if they do? They have Cutter Crawford coming back. Obviously, Bayo's in the mix. Crochet leading the way. So kind of got to wait and see what the rotation looks like come February, March. But you got to figure that both Early and Tolley pitch more in the majors than the minors this upcoming year. So are you intrigued at all by Connelly Early or Peyton Tolley here, Paul?
Very. I like both. I don't like saying Connelly Early's name. I don't think you should be able to have an L-Y first and last name. It's a bad mouthfeel. Pick one or the other. But I do like how he pitches, and that will not prevent me from taking him, because that would be a very stupid reason not to take somebody. But yeah, the four start sample was excellent, kind of put him on the radar for everybody. But he was having a really strong minor league season as well. So if you do follow the minors, of course, if you listen to this podcast, you definitely do. So you knew about him already. You got the jump on folks, and hopefully he took the plunge when he came up and got those four starts. I do think he has the leg up right now. The draft market absolutely does. If you want to take Tolley in like a draft and hold, I think that makes some sense, because you are getting a nice discount and you don't need everybody playing on opening day in a 50 team draft and hold anyway. So even if he doesn't come up until May, that's fine. Like, I don't purposely draft guys that I know will be in the minors, but I'm not going to like run from somebody like that on a pitching side, right? When you're drafting 50 players with 15 other teams, you can't be so picky once you start turning the rounds into the 30s and the 40s. And so, and Tolley doesn't even get that far, by the way. But even if he comes in as the sixth or seventh starter, I think that's okay, because I don't think there was any way where he was going to get a full season, even if he breaks camp, right? Like, they're not going to turn him loose for $170. I don't think so. And I don't think he's necessarily ready for that either. Early, I do think, is a bit closer to that. He's a year older. He's had multiple triple-digit workloads as a professional. So I think he's just a cut above. They view him as that as well. You should be drafting as such, but don't leave Tolley completely out in the dark if you play in a deep enough league where somebody who plays for even 4 months can be valuable enough. And then on that draft and hold piece, you're not making moves anyway, so you are kind of drafting some of your waiver picks if you want to look at Tolley like that as a later pickup. Because I still like his upside, I think, is probably richer. Like, I think he could actually be maybe a full ace if things like really, really, really worked out. It would take a long way to get there, but like, he's got the raw stuff for it. But early is going to be a fantasy asset, I believe, next year. Like, he has a really strong chance to be a nice piece for you for 130 innings.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've very much been more early over Tolley in 2026 drafts than long term. I still do. I like both, but I do like Tolley a little bit more. I think there's, like you said, there's a bit more upside there. You know, he throws harder. He can miss more bats. I think the bat missing potential long term is a bit higher, especially if he starts going to the secondaries a little bit more. I mean,
yes,
he was very four seam cutter heavy. That was like 84-ish%.
Yeah, once he figures out and gets comfortable with the changing curve, it's over. Like, Tolley's potential development, and we'll see if it goes, but his potential development, again, is that of an ace. When you come in with a 119 stuff plus, even in a small sample like this, stuff plus is something that starts to stabilize quickly. You know, Sarris will tell you that. So even 16 in the third innings, while still a small sample, it's not a lie that Tolley's stuff is amazing, but it came with a 92 location plus as well. So he doesn't always know where it's going. And like you said, he was very fastball heavy as he's kind of getting his feet wet, having some struggles. Totally makes sense. But his development path, and if it comes quickly, it could already be next year, but I'm planning in my head for more of a 27 breakout for Peyton Tolley.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. And again, I want to see what the Red Sox do if they go out and trade for a Joe Ryan or Freddie Peralta, whoever it might be.
That'd be hot to pair with Crochet.
Oh, that would be just my dream offseason is like trading for, let's just say, Joe Ryan, because those rumors were already out there, the trade deadline, and then going out and getting like a Pete Alonso to play first base. That's like my dream. I know, that's like,
you guys, that'd be so nice for y'all, because you guys got that great system. I mean, Red Sox fans, I know you had a heartbreaking finish to the year, but you're in such a good spot right now.
Yeah, I know. It's like they're so close. I'm like, just get those few extra pieces and put them up the top. So,
And that's the way you do it. You go out, you trade some of these assets. The reason you have a system this deep is to then flip some pieces. It'll barely affect them, even if they trade a big dog. Even if, I don't know who you think would be the headliner in that, but even if it's Meyer or something, or Campbell, I don't know who's a Joe Ryan headliner, but like, even if it's a big dog, it's not going to kill the team. And it is the right move to go out and get another ace, I think, to go with Crochet.
Hunter, that's what I've been saying too. I'm like, outside of for like all the rookies or prospects, obviously Roman Anthony is untouchable.
Yeah, he would not be.
I'm fine. I'd like to hold on to one of Tolley or early, but if you need to get them into a deal, fine. I'm fine trading. Even though I still like Christian Campbell, Meyer, all these guys, I'm fine. Garcia, whatever.
This is why you build this deep.
100%. If it gets me Joe Ryan, Hunter Green, whoever, sign me up all day. I will do that 10 times out of 10. All right, let's finish off the American League with Troy Melton from Paul's Detroit Tigers. Paul mentioned him on his pitcher panel on, I think it was Saturday morning at First Pitch Arizona. Really good season, mostly in the bullpen for Melton. Did make a handful of starts, overall 45 and two-thirds innings, but pitched well in those innings, 2.76 ERA, 1.01 whip, you know, solid walk rate just above 8%. Key rate wasn't quite there, but you definitely saw some intrigue here from Troy Melton and some potential breakout appeal here in 2026. So how much are you liking Troy Melton here?
Quite a bit. He was my breakout pick. You know, we had an outline that we followed and talked about a bunch of guys in different categories. And then at the end, pick one, you know, pick somebody that you like. And I went with Troy Melton, not just as a homer pick, you know. Anyone that's listened to my stuff or read it long enough knows I'm not just a crazy homer that's Tigers this, Tigers that. But when we got a good one, I'm happy to promote it. And I think Troy Melton is that dude. He's been an awesome minor leaguer, too. And he's been a little bit obscured in the depth of that system. You know, a lot of Jackson Jobe, even Matt Manning was getting a ton of love, of which I was part of, I'll admit. But, you know,
me too.
I couldn't help but fall for him. But then Troy Melton kind of got obscured. And all the way up, he's just been a really strong guy, missing a ton of bats, not walking too many, having a little bit of a homer issue. But part of that goes back to the walk rate. Again, when you're going to live in the zone, you're going to have some home runs. Ideally, they're going to be solos. And I think that that can be refined. I think he's got a deep enough arsenal to figure out how to live in the zone and not get beat with fastballs or to get beat with the home run ball. 97 mile per hour heat. I mean, he's got all the tools. And I do think after this year, what do we have here? That's 122 innings plus a little bit in the playoffs. And I think he would only had what, maybe two innings in the playoffs. But either way, he's ready for a big season. I think he's ready for 165 plus innings this year for Troy Melton. And I'm really, really excited about what he can do. He did add another eight. And, you know, in terms of experience, I've heard both Smoltz and Verlander say you count about 1.25 to 1.5 for innings in the playoffs, at least in terms of, first off, wear and tear, but also for, like, the experience that they're giving you. So even if you want to count that eight as closer to 12 or whatever and tack that on to things, then you're talking about a guy who had, like, 130-plus innings of experience. I don't see why they can't get a $170 out of him. And he's got the edge on a job right now. I know Sawyer, Gibson, Long fans are a little bit bummed on that. He'll likely be the team's six. You know, Flaherty's back, so it's going to be Scooble, Flaherty, Mize, Locked, and then Olson, depending on his health, and then Melton right there at the five while they still have some depth behind them. I just think Melton's ready to be an absolute stud.
Yeah, now I think the silver lining, if there is a silver lining to a guy like Jackson Jobe needing Tommy John, is that maybe this gives Troy Melton the chance to pop off that he might not have gotten if Jobe was healthy right now heading into 2026. And he had his surgery in mid-June, so you got to imagine it's like all-star break at the earliest for Jackson Jobe. So you at least get
by the time he's back. Yes, exactly. By the time he's back, unfortunately, Olson will be hurt again. And I hope I'm wrong on that, but I was such a huge fan, and I remain a huge fan, too, by the way, because the talent was still there. I think we're both justified. You know, the 69 innings that we did get were nice, and I'm not just doing the meme. Like, he did pitch well, but we got to see it. I was really hoping that after 104 and 112 innings that we were going to get the $150 from Olson. I think they give him another chance this year at age 26. But if he flops again, then they might just be trying to shorten his innings. Even though that doesn't work, by the way, moving to the bullpen or making a guy to it, that doesn't keep you any healthier. But I do worry that if Olson can't make it through another season, that maybe they give up letting him be a full-time starter.
Oh, probably. Yeah, I've always been a big Reese Olson guy too, and I had a lot of shares last year, and it was, yeah, like you said, looking good early in the year, and then unfortunately, it's another prolonged IL stint.
Yeah. I'll be back in, though, because, again, the market's going to drop him for us. He's down to 270. That's actually a little bit more expensive than I expected. I'll be curious if he holds that all year. He's actually right in between Quinn Priester and Joey Cantillo, so that's a tougher decision than I thought because I like all three of those guys. Yeah. But generally, though, I still do like Olson. As long as he's healthy, I don't see any reason he can't be good as well.
Yeah, 100%. All right, over to the National League now, starting with Nolan McLean, who just went absolute gangbusters on the National League, you know, hitters end of the season. Eight starts, 2.06 ERA, 1.04 WHIP, 8.5% walk rate, 30.3% strikeout rate. And if you just watch him, it's, you know, wiffle ball stuff. He has two pitches, honestly, one with above 3,000 spin rate on average, but two that are above 2,900. Sweeper and curveball, like, he can spin them with the best of them. And this is a guy that, you know, he's still learning how to be, he's still like new to being a full-time pitcher because he was a two-way player as about like roughly 2 years ago.
Yeah,
I think when he gave up being a hitter. So this is a guy that's only been a full-time pitcher for 2 years, and he's already, you know, maybe, you know, probably is the ace of the New York Mets at this point after just eight starts. So exciting stuff, exciting, you know, stats and exciting metrics right now already popping off. So are you buying the big pop-off we saw from Nolan McLean?
This one's tough because I love the talent. This is a guy that I discovered, and I say discovered, I mean for me, in out-of-the-park baseball. Because, like, when you play an offline sim, they have, like, the first three or four or five seasons of prospects loaded in to give you real-life prospects for each of your drafts. I think for four seasons. They get all the data from Perfect Game. And so in a couple of my sims a couple of years ago, Nolan McLean always had these two-way stats. And I was like, who the hell is this guy, this pitcher, who's got some, like, actual hitting? You know, because he had, like, some real pop. And so that's how I learned about him. And I kind of kept tabs on him through that. I totally had no idea who he was until seeing him in Out of the Park Baseball. Obviously learned he was a real guy. It wasn't like a fictional guy that was being built into the game. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's such a beast. You know, he's a two-way stud. And now, as he's, like you said, still just learning pitching. He's just learning the finer points. He went the other way with the walk rate stuff. He was putting double digits all the way up this year, double and triple A. He gets to the majors, 8.5. And I don't usually go for the decimal. I did it just because it sounds better than 9, but even 9, we'll take it. I'm somebody who likes to round because I don't think 8.5 versus 9. I don't think there's any precision there to be gained. So I'm doing that a little bit with tongue in cheek. But 9%, again, we'll take that. What did I say with Cantillo? You know, if your stuff is that good, and his stuff is way better than Cantillo's, if your stuff is that good, just be under 10% walk rate. Anything under 10, I'll take 9.8. We'll round it to 10, but give me anything under 10%. I can live with when you're striking out 30% of your batters. He is so nasty. The problem, if there is one, is that the market totally agrees with everything I'm saying and then some. He is pick 108, Eric, and I don't know, man. Listen, I buy in on guys on small samples. I try to trust the talent that I'm seeing. You know, I'm not afraid of necessarily buying a lighter track record, but a near top 100 pick for 50, not even 50 major league innings is a little tough, and I think I'm a little gun shy, so I just don't know. And it is less about McClain, and then you look at who's going right by him, like Carlos Rodon, or even somebody last year who didn't pitch but is back in the market completely, Kyle Bradish. He barely pitched, I should say. He pitched down the stretch. I think I'd rather go there. I think I'd rather go Nick Lodolo, even though I have some concerns about him. He's 30 picks cheaper. Should Nick Lodolo be 30 picks cheaper than Nolan McClain?
I don't know. I mean,
even understanding, because any
injuries with him.
Right, and the home park. Right, those are the two big things people will say, and I agree, because I'm actually a little bit of a Lodolo disliker in terms of his draft price. I get nervous about Cincinnati guys. So I'm not even a Lodolo guy here, but I'm still saying, like, I think I've seen so much more out of him as a major leaguer, even understanding the injuries. He did go $1.56 this year. He did have 28 starts, 29 appearances. So even though injury did hit again, he still had a full season. I don't know. McClain, the hype is just too high. To put a bow on it, I just can't do it at that price point. Not with the guys going around him.
Yeah, no, that's fair. He out of all these, all the hype guys this year, he has the highest ADP, or the earliest ADP, I should say, by I think a good two rounds or so. And I think the next guy in ADP might be this next guy here, who is probably my favorite long term out of all of these guys, and that's saying something because I like a lot of these guys. Chase Burns.
Yes. You
know, 1.5. He had a couple blow ups, so the ERA ballooned to 4.57. Mm-hmm. But just look at 67 strikeouts and 43 in the third innings. And something I mentioned on my panel, the rookies for 26 panel, was if you look at starting pitchers with at least 40 innings this century, only two guys had a higher strikeout minus walk rate than Chase Burns. It was Spencer Strider in 2022. And Steven Strasburg back in what year was that? 2010, 11, 12, I forget. Summer's around there. I forget the exact year.
But I think that it was just 10. Shows,
I mean, those two guys obviously
10,
phenomenal.
You nailed it.
2010, okay, yeah. I knew it was summer's around there. But yeah, and obviously the whip was a little high. And, there's the the home ball par. He's kind of only a two pitch guy right now, though. Threw the changeup 10% against lefties. It is a decent changeup, just barely ever uses it. But that slider is so filthy. He can hit triple digits. I mean, you look at, this is kind of just more of a fun thing that I like to see, on Savant, obviously the similar pitchers to, Chase Burns based on velo movement. Three of those names are Jacob DeGrom, Hunter Green, and Dylan Cease.
That's unbelievable. I love that. I like looking at this stuff too. It doesn't mean I draft them because of that or think that he's that guy. I agree with you. I know you're putting that caveat in so people don't think you're saying that he is them, but it's trying to express how disgusting Chase Burns' stuff is.
Yep.
It is so top tier. And, again, 43 innings, so again, a tiny sample. You mentioned the park. I've always been scared of Hunter Green, usually because of his park and injury combo. We mentioned Lodolo, same thing, park and injury combo. And Hunter Green, I was like, I'm off of him this year because I don't think the home runs are going to hold. I was right about that part. It didn't matter, though, Eric, because he's so good that even though his home runs went from 0.7 to 1.3, he kept his ERA exactly the same from 2.75 to 2.76, and he lowered his whip from 102 to 0.94. Now, it took 3 years to get there. And so what I'm saying is I'm making some links here on purpose between Burns and Green. I think we got the blueprint. We've seen it. I think we could go through some of the similar struggles. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that I wouldn't pay the price for 135 here on the chance that Burns gets to the Green level quicker than Green did. I'm willing to take that bet because, first off, his strikeout to walk rate day one has been better. I think his raw stuff and more importantly, his raw command profile, I think, is better day one than Green's is. So I do think a 135 ADP, while still high, and I've balked on some of these guys, I think he's the one I'd pay for right now in this 130s range between Burns, Schlittler, and Yasavage. I mentioned Schlittler over Yasavage. Burns is a little bit more expensive at 135 to Schlittler's 137. If it's between those two, it's Burns easily for me.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I think Burns can be a true ace, especially if he develops that change up a little bit more, makes a legit third offering. 100%. I think he's a legit ace in this league, and I do not throw around that term lightly. I think there's only like a few prospects / rookies that have that ace frontline upside,
right?
And Chase Burns is absolutely one of them. So, yeah, I do lean Burns over McLean as well. I think both are phenomenal arms, obviously. But, yeah, I've always been a huge Burns guy. He's my number one pitching prospect for a reason. And yeah, I think the upside is absolutely massive with him.
And just to show like that I'm what I'm saying about how I don't just only go for guys with calm demeanor. I love Chase Burns and he's a freak.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I love that about him.
He's got that dog in him for sure.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, he's out there. He's always amped up.
He's hyped as hell and I'm cool with it.
Yeah. This next guy kind of falls under that boat too. And right there in the NL Central, Jacob Mizierowski. Mm-hmm. I think especially anybody that, has followed prospect rankings, like this guy has always been so incredibly hard to rank just because it's almost like the minor league version of like Tyler Glass now where it's like elite right. stuff, but there's been some injuries. There's been a super high walk rate. Then that came down this year. That's when he got his call up to Milwaukee, kind of up and down stint with Milwaukee. But another guy had a ton of strikeouts, 87 in 66 innings, 32% strikeout rate. Walk rate was 11%. But with his stuff, and you kind of mentioned earlier, which I've always called the Freddy Peralta rule, if you can keep your walk rate in that 9-10% range,
yes,
while having elite swing and miss stuff, if you're having like a 30-ish percent K rate, that can play. So, with Mizierowski, can he keep it in the 10% range? He's shown a little bit he can, not like a huge track record of keeping it there. So I'm still kind of, a little gun shy about fully going all in on him like I am on Chase Burns. But, man, it's hard to argue that there's any more exciting pitcher. Or he's like top five just on pure excitement. When you're throwing 100, 102, when you have 95-mile-an-hour sliders, 92-mile-an-hour changeups, like everything is just nasty and hard. For this guy, like his slowest pitch is an 87-mile-an-hour curveball, which is very hard for a curveball. Probably, yes. I think average curveball velocity is probably like 81 or something like that. So, very exciting profile, but some red flags here. So, how do you balance all that out? And are you a Mizierowski guy, Paul?
Oh, man,
it's hard
this
not
group
to be,
is
right?
So tough. Yeah, it's impossible not to be. Like, when you look at the stuff, like, am I in on him as an elite talent? Absolutely. Can I pay the buck 35? He's right here in this exact same class that we've been talking about. This is why, called it the hype 7 here, because all these guys go in a tight band too. So put Mizierowski right there at 135. Chase Burns and him have technically the same ADP at average of 135. Obviously, they can't both go 135 in a draft, but they're right there in that same range. And between those two, man, I would really labor on that because I don't know that I can make major distinctions between them. Yes, Burns's walk rate was better in the majors. And I think he probably does have a better command profile right now. But Mizierowski's stuff was absolutely obscene. I think he located better than his walk rate might make you think. And I think that's where something like Location Plus can help. It was 104, so he was 4% better than league average, which again, you might not think that with an 11% walk rate. So I'm with you. He needs to get that in that 9 range that we want, 9% or better. But even if he doesn't, the strikeout upside is so huge. And the upside, if he hits, right? We talk a lot about downside and like how these guys can end up being cut or, sent back to the minors or do a 5.12 ERA. I obviously understand that the upside is low, that they're going to reach like ace status, but it is top 20 SP season if they hit, right? So you have to decide, is pick 130 somewhere where you want to make that boom bust pick? Do you want to take somebody maybe a little bit more stable but boring as hell like Luis Castillo? Okay, I think league type would determine that. And maybe a deeper league, you'd be more inclined to do that because the replacement level isn't going to be as high. But in a shallower league, you take the shiny new toy like a Mizorowski or Burns because you can probably get a Castillo-type substance in a 10 or 12 team waiver wire. So that is probably the delineation that I make. Now, not Castillo specifically. I probably still wouldn't take him. But maybe like a Michael King who goes in that spot, I think I would take in the deeper leagues.
Yeah,
so like I think I'm going to go with a Michael King or even a Pablo Lopez if we have reports that he's all healthy and everything. Did he finish the season on the mound, Lopez?
I can't remember either.
If he did, I would put him in that category as well with King, where I'd probably take them because those two are going right in the 140s. So they're going right behind that group of hype guys. Yeah, he did. Oh, 919. So he came back in September, but he did finish on the IL for Lopez. So he would be TBD depending on his health. But I would take Michael King over the hype guys in deeper formats. I think in a 10 team, I'm still going to go Burns then Mizorowski. I'm a coin flip on them every day. I think you ask me. You could ask me every day, and I might change my answer damn near every day.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I think for 2026, I go Burns. Then probably, like, out of all these guys, then probably Mizorowski McLean. Burns is my one. The two M's, I'm kind of...
Burns, McLean, Miz is probably where I'm at.
Yeah,
which means I could change Savage. All three. Because if I'm saying I could put Burns over Mizorowski or Mizorowski over Burns on any given day, that would mean McLean could then move around too. Is it McLean or McLean? I don't know which. So if I'm saying it wrong, chat, let me know.
I've always gone McLean, and I haven't been corrected.
Yeah, I've gone McLean all the way through, and he's more expensive too, right? He is 30 picks higher than them. So if it's on a crossed basis, it is definitely Burns, Mizorowski, then McLean that I would be interested in. I think I'm just passing McLean at pick 105,
which is totally fair. But to your point, like, would it surprise you? I think the three, if you told me, like, out of all these guys we've talked about, that three of them were going to be drafted as top 15, top 20 arms next year as, like, basically fantasy aces. I'd probably say if I had to pick three, I'd probably be those three we just mentioned, McLean and Burns and Mizorowski, more, a little bit more so than, like, Schiller and your Savage and all them. So
Totally agree. And I would throw an outside shot to my boy Melton again, not just because he's a Tiger, but the depth of Arsenal combined with the velocity is what intrigues me so much. Eric Samulski did an amazing presentation on what it takes to be a top 25 type pitcher. And he had this whole rubric that he laid out of things that he looks at, these checklists. You don't have to hit every single one, but these are things that you look at, and then if they don't hit a threshold, understand why and how can they get there, and do they have something to cover for it. And it was just such an amazing presentation. Former teacher, I learned, and it made sense why he was so good, because everything was just so crystal clear, easy to take away the information. And the depth of Arsenal for Melton is such an additional bonus to having 97. You can live with 97 and have two pitchers, right? We see guys do it, right? We're watching Burns basically do it if that changeup isn't there right now. But when you have 5-6 pitches as well, and you can throw that hard, it just gives you such a wider margin for error. So that's why I love Melton too. And I think he could sneak up there. But I'm with you that it would be the two M's and Burns that I would pick to be fantasy aces in 2027 if we had to pick that right now.
Yeah, and you can tell Eric's a I agree. I was at that presentation. Phenomenal, great work. And then when he had the initial hand just of the top 25 pitchers from last year, and he had the big stack. He's like, here, take one and pass it around.
Yeah,
those were the take one and pass it around.
Pass it around.
How many times did we hear that in school growing up?
Yep. Paul?
So,
I missed the early part. So that's, you know, I wasn't there for the first few minutes. And if I had heard that, I would have known he was a teacher instantly. But like about a quarter of the way through, I lean over to Nick. I'm like, he is amazing at this. He's like, yeah, he's a former teacher. I was like, okay, that makes every bit of sense in the world.
100% does. All right. Two more names. And then we got a little group of players at the end. We'll just kind of fire through another NL Central guy, Cade Horton, who just finished second in National League Rookie of the Year voting to Drake Baldwin, but a very, very good year from Horton, and, you know, maybe one of the best. It was like him and Rogers were like two of the best pitchers in the second half of the season. Overall for Horton, he made 23 starts, 118 innings, 2.67 ERA, 1.08 WHIP. Another guy where, you know, the WHIF rate and the K rate don't really line up. It was a below average strikeout rate, but an above average whiff rate, and a guy that's always had good swing and miss stuff. I mean, he throws hard, about 96. He's got a good sweeper, solid changeup as well. Look at those secondaries. Sweeper, changeup, curveball, all between like 10 and 20% usage rate. All had a batting average against under 200. You know, two of those had a whiff rate above 36%. The changeup was 48%. So I definitely think that K rate ticks up. Like, he's not going to be a 20.4% K rate guy next year. So, you know, maybe that ERA ticks up a little bit, you know, maybe more like 3.3, 3.4. But if he's that with a 20, you know, above average K rate, that's still like a top 40 or so arms. Maybe he's not on that level of the M's or the Burns's, even the Savages. I still think there's a really, really good pitcher here with Cade Horton. So, yeah, I'm definitely a believer in Horton. But what say you, Paul?
I am as well. And he goes down at pick 180. I think you said that. Sorry, I was looking it up when I thought I heard you say it and I wasn't paying attention fully. But either way, he's 180 ADP. So he is cheaper than that group for a reason, because he's not quite as developed. But I think without fully analyzing the repertoire, because I don't have the minor league data and I wouldn't know exactly where to find it, but I wonder, did he sacrifice some of his strikeout rate for the control boost? Because at AAA, Cade Horton, albeit in a small sample, was 31% Ks, 12% walk. He gets to the majors and goes 20% Ks, but only 7% walk. That's a trade I am okay with a youngster making when you have 96 on your velo and an arsenal of pitches. Again, going back to what we talked about with depth of arsenal. And he had both of those things. Now, he ran a 258 BABIP, and if that had been closer to 300, no, he wouldn't have had a 267 ERA. But there's a lot of wiggle room between 267 and like not being useful in fantasy. So even if the BABIP does regress, which we expect it to just by nature of BABIP, like you said, 3.3, 3.5 range for an ERA with a good whip if he keeps the walk rate while improving the strikeout rate. Because that's what I think his next step is going to be for Horton, is to let me incorporate my nastiness of stuff to get back to my strikeouts without giving up all the walks so that I keep that balance. So I'm really intrigued by him. And this weekend back in Arizona really crystallized how good he was for me, because I had kind of missed just how excellent he was down the stretch. And I could not believe when I was looking at the game log, I was like, damn, I kind of missed it because I didn't have him on any team. But Cade Horton, he was winning people leagues in April and September.
Yeah, no, he absolutely was, and unfortunately, I did not have any shares of him. That was a miss on my part, but hey, you live and you learn. But yeah, Cade Horton, yeah, I think he's always had, you know, the sweeper has always been a good pitch for him, and I do agree, you know, think what you said was true in the sense that I think he did kind of like dial it back a bit to get, you know, a little bit more command than he had. Not that he was ever like bad command control in the minors.
No.
He definitely kind of made that trade off a little bit. And maybe he, you know, we've seen guys do that and then the next year go kind of take that next step back forward with, you know, the sexy stuff, right? The swing and miss stuff. So while maintaining the gains you made in command and control. So and I think Horton, and he's another guy that's still, you know, compared to others his age, a little bit on the, you know, lesser experience side, a little bit rawer than most. You know, he broke out like his last year.
Didn't he also hit at OU? I think he did.
I think
he was flirting with a little two-way potential, not as rigorously as McClain, but right. I think he had a little two-way vibe as well, Cade Horton. So yeah, I mean, that's the only bad thing about him is that he went to OU, but he can't fix that now. So we'll have to just push forward with the hook 'em horns, baby.
Right. There you go. All right, last name before we get into like the kind of bigger glob of names at the end. This guy definitely had the worst year out of all of these names. Talent-wise, he's, you know, quite on par, but he's up there in terms of just arm talent. But unfortunately, he has R-O-C-K-I-E-S across the front of his jersey. So Chase Dolander, overall 6.52 ERA. In 21 starts, 155 WHIP, and probably the most radical home road splits you'll ever see. On the road this year, in 10 starts, 3.46 ERA, 117 WHIP, pretty damn solid. At home, 9.98 ERA and a 1.98 WHIP. It's just it's a guy that you see the potential like on the road. Right. Like, all right, this guy could be maybe not like a frontline guy, but this guy could be like a top 40, top 50 fantasy arm. But obviously, you just can't start him in half your games. So, like, you know, do you have any interest at all here, Paul, or are you just out because of where he plays?
I really am in most cases with Dolander. I can't, because it's half a pitcher and it's on the road where players are historically worse for obvious reasons. They're not in their home park. They're on the road traveling. You know, it's just more uncomfortable to be on the road. Now, Rockies pitchers are obviously a unique beast where a lot of them are better just by virtue of the fact that they're not in that crazy park anymore. So I do understand that. And I expect that he can maintain being better, but it puts so much pressure on his road work. And it also means that, like, any bomb on the road just stings so much, because you're only going to get, what, like 12, 13 starts out of him anyway. I don't know. Maybe a draft champions where, again, where we're getting so late, it's pick 600. You know he's going to get an opportunity, right? He threw 98 innings this year. I mean, it's the Rockies. I shouldn't say anything obvious that they're going to do, because they don't do the obvious stuff. But generally, you would think the 24-year-old pitcher who threw 98 innings would have an opportunity to take 30 turns next year and get, you know, 160-plus innings. So you could at least get maybe closer to 15 road starts. So I could see maybe trying to milk that in a draft champions, but that's really it. And that's a 50-round draft and old. So it has to be in, like, the round 40s or something. So, no, I like Dolander. My heart literally sank a little bit when he got drafted to the Rockies, as it does with any intriguing pitcher. I'm glad Jeff Hoffman finally got out of there. It took a while last year when he went to Philly, and then this year with Toronto. But I always loved him, but he was a Colorado Rocky. And John Gray, loved him, but he's a Colorado Rocky. So, yeah, Dolander, you can't really draft him anywhere but something crazy deep where the volume alone might be worth it to start him seven times.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up, like, the DC or just the deeper format where, like, all right, if you have a deep enough bench, I'm like, all right, you can start him in just the road starts.
Yeah.
Especially maybe, you know, those maybe a couple weeks a year where you might have two road starts in one single week. Yeah, if you can get, like, 15 starts, you know, 80 to 85 innings of a mid-3 ERA and solid K rate, yeah, I think that can have some value there, as long as you just make sure you bench him whenever he's, you know, playing course. But, yeah, outside of that, it's hard to – even like this shows that even this probably is the best arm, or at least if not the best, one of the top two or three arms that Colorado has ever had in terms of talent. But Coors Field remains undefeated.
Remains undefeated, man. And that, you know, this is old news now at this point, but I remember getting in a bunch of little Twitter spats about Marquez, about how he'd figured it out. And I said, no, he didn't, because no one does.
Same here.
And it was just like, these people wanted to fight me tooth and nail. And I'm like, what are we doing here? This is the most guaranteed lock bet ever. Coors always wins. It's a bummer, but it is what it is. And so just you can't get attached to pitchers there. It's a losing proposition.
Unfortunately, even Dolander can't make it work, unfortunately. Sad, but yeah, it's true. All right, there were so many other good, like, these were the kind of like the most exciting names to talk about. There's a bunch of other good rookies this year that had varying levels of success and innings. So I figured I'd just mention all these names and see if, you know, Paul, any of these guys stand out to you, you know, either positively, negatively, like, oh, hey, I'm avoiding that guy altogether, or, hey, I like this guy, he's a sleeper, whatever. However you want to roll with it. But a few other names here: Chad Patrick from Milwaukee, Shane Smith from the White Sox, Jack Leiter from the Rangers, Jacob Lopez from the Athletics, Will Warren from the Yankees, and Hurston Waldrop from the Braves. Any name positively or negatively stand out there for you, Paul?
We'll start with Jacob Lopez and basically just say that he's a baby Dolander, meaning you can really only use him in half the starts. I think Sacramento really started to play the way we all expected it would down the stretch. It took a while for the summer to heat up there. Justin Mason, who lives out in that area, was kind of on that all year. Like, oh, we've had an unseasonably cool summer. And then it kind of turned in, like, late July into August, and we saw that everyone was getting bombed out there after a while, including Lopez himself. So again, it really mitigates how often you can use him, because you almost never want to use him at home. I like the talent, but I just don't know that I can trust him. Shane Smith's the one I really want to dial in on. If I can backpedal a little on a tough season, I'm going to take a few wins. I was really keyed in on him after seeing him in spring. He just came away really impressive. Learned that he came from the Milwaukee system, a system I generally trust. And some of their runoff, you know, when you're deep enough system, your runoff talent, your guys that you can't keep because of the Rule 5, is going to be intriguing. You know, a lot of times I'm going to at least look where you got a Rule 5 guy from. And if it's from a particularly deep and strong organization, that will get my attention. That made me put a little star on Shane Smith before the spring. Then I watched him in spring, and it was only only a small couple small samples, but I just really came away liking what he was doing. Thought he had a chance to win the job. He took it. He pitched really well too. And he even had a really nice trajectory where he came out really hot. Shane Smith was like the talk of the town for a while as like this out of nowhere White Sox pitcher. Hit the skids big time for a nice little 6-7 start lull there. We're like, ah, this, he pumpkined, he stinks. I even cut him at that time, to be honest, because I was like, well, I got a lot of innings of a 3.70 ERA. Let me get out of here before this really craters. But he bounced back and he finished strong, and that really, really impressed me. I still stand by the decision to cut him because it made sense for where I was and where I thought maybe his season was going to go. But the fact that he rallied and finished strong really impressed me. So he's made it through the ringer of a 29 start season, so not quite 30, but that's good enough for me. And I think this White Sox team is on the rise. I've been saying it since the beginning of last year. They were still bad this year. I didn't say they were going to be good, but their system is good, and they're starting to put more and more quality talent on the major league team. I think this is the year 26 where they're going to take a step. And by a step, I mean, you know, going from 60 wins to like 74, but a 14 win improvement is pretty huge. And that would make Shane Smith pretty viable in all formats because you could actually expect to win every once in a while.
Yep. No, absolutely. I was just going to say that too, that the White Sox are starting to build something. And I was talking with Mike Carter out there in Arizona. He's a White Sox guy, and he's got some positivity back, you know, after a couple really tough years, obviously, with the White Sox. But what did they combine for, like maybe 85 wins combined the last 2 years or something like that?
Oh, my God. So I think it is that bad.
It's been, it was like 41 and then 40.
Oh, no. They had 60 this year. So 101 wins the last 2 years. Yeah, because, again, they played a bit better down the stretch, too. So they've already started to show a little bit with some of the prospects coming up. 11 and 14, you're not going to write home about a 440 win percentage, but that's pretty good for a crappy team down the stretch to, you know, be competitive. And so that's the first step there. And I think they're just going to be adding more and more talent around guys like Smith. And I don't think it's going to cost him his job, by the way, because first off, I think they're bringing up mostly hitting talent anyway, but I don't think there's a ton of pitching talent that's going to force him out. I think at the very least, Shane Smith, even if everything works out for the White Sox and they really turn this thing around by 27, 28, he could still be a mid-rotation guy for them. He's only 25 years old, or 26 next year.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree there. The one I wanted to mention real quick, Hurston Waldrop with the Atlanta Braves. He's a guy that, you know, I used to like a lot, but the fastball was terrible. And the fastball still isn't great, but he's kind of gone more. He kind of switched it up. He was more four-seamer back then. It was a bad four-seamer. Just look at, I mean, small sample size in 2024, but the four-seamer had a 308 batting average against and a 769 slug. That's terrible. But then he went more sinker-cutter this year, barely even used the four-seamer. He's still very splitter-heavy, but it's a very, very good splitter, 150 batting average against, 225 slug, and a 45% whiff rate. And he started throwing a curveball more. I'm like, good, add that breaking ball in. He kind of gave up the slider, went more with a curveball. Still has a slider, but the arsenal changed, and I think it changed for the better. You know, granted, he's still, you know, very predictable because 42 out of his, what was it total? Out of his 55 strikeouts were on that splitter. So they kind of know, like, all right, two strikes. Good chance.
You know what you're getting.
But at the same time, they knew it and they still couldn't hit it. Like, right. I already mentioned those metrics. So I like the way he kind of switched up the arsenal a bit. And I'm not as high at him as I am a lot of these other guys, but I think there's some intrigue there. He'll be in that rotation to start the year. So I think there's definitely some intrigue and some additional breakout potential for Waldrop, who had a 2.88 ERA, 1.19 WHIP, and right around a strikeout per inning. A little bit of a higher walk rate guy. He's in that 9-10% range as well, but definitely some upside. And if that kind of the arsenal changes that we saw this past year stick, you know, maybe even goes to the curveball even more. You know, I think there's some additional breakout potential there from Waldrop.
And Waldrop's on an org that will trust their young starters when they're excelling. They don't 100%. Just limit them artificially. If they're pitching well, they're going. So, yeah, I like Waldrop. I think that's a good shout. 5-pitch arsenal. And when we call something a pitch, folks, it's the shorthand there is that they throw it at least 10% of the time. And for him, it's at least 11% with all five of the pitches. So, yeah, lots to like with Waldrop as well.
All right. That's going to wrap us up. Paul, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you as always, catching up with you out in Arizona. What do you got going on right now?
Well, thanks for having me on, Eric. I really appreciate it. We are getting the pod going. We take the month of October. We kind of decompress a little bit. So we did the Fall League one, which will go up Tuesday if you're listening to this. I don't know. When are you putting this out?
It'll be on Tuesday, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So if you're listening to this on Tuesday, you can find a Sleeper in the Bust episode on Tuesday as well. And then we'll be back on a regular schedule a couple times a week. I got some articles coming out. I'm working on starting pitcher write-ups right now. That's why I haven't had as many articles, because I'm getting all my write-ups done for the big rankings release, which will be coming before you know it. I mean, I know it's only November 10th, and we're looking at, I think, a December 3rd release or something, whatever. Oh no, I think Monday is December 1st. So yeah, I think it is supposed to be a December 1st release for our big rankings, but that'll be here before you know it. So yeah, that's what basically what I'm working on, is an occasional article. We'll have more pods going, and then the big first wave release of the SP rankings on December 1st.
Awesome. It's that time of year where us degenerates are already looking ahead to 2020. It's never too early. Baseball never dies. But thanks again to Paul Sporer. Obviously, follow him on Twitter at Sporer, S-P-O-R-E-R. Sleeper in the Bus podcast, obviously the best in the business. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back with you again next week. But until then, everyone take care.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.